Good evening, everybody. My name is Darren. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Darren.
Sobriety date is February 16, 2018. My home group is Fellowship of the Spirit, based out of Ventnor, New Jersey. We meet every Wednesday night, 7:30. We're a big book study. If you happen to come down to the South Shore this summer, come and see us. Thank you all for having me again for another week. That's always somewhat of a good sign, I think. I didn't get a call midweek saying, you know what, we're okay, we got it covered this week. So here I am again. Last week I kind of gave you an overview of what the steps look like, some of the things that I've had and walked through during those steps, identified a little bit and spent some time on one. Right, the book spends close to 60 pages really digging in and trying to drill home the idea of what alcohol does to me. And that's convinced me that I need something greater than me. And that's the truth to me of what step one really is, and that's beyond human aid. And alcohol's job is to convince me of that. My experience is that it did. I had a true first step experience, which means when I got to this, and the book talks about we either went on to the bitter end or we accepted spiritual help. That has been my experience once I got to that point. And that means in every step that I've come to, in every moment that I've come to, it doesn't mean I haven't slacked, doesn't mean I haven't rested on my laurels. But when presented with the fork in the road, what I've done is seen my opportunity to pick up that spiritual toolkit and accept that help and move on from that. Including things like the nightly inventory, which is a challenge when you have 16-hour days, 18-hour days. You want to just kind of breeze right through that. And I've sat down to do that inventory, and I fell asleep in that little quiet time and woken up 20 minutes later like, wow, that was a really good meditation. It wasn't. It was me sleeping. But I still go back and I address it, and I do my nightly inventory, right? The reason why I bring that up is because you're talking to you're looking at a man whose idea of God I couldn't imagine would be useful in sobriety, and that was angry, vengeful, spiteful. He had allowed some things to happen to me as a child, or so I thought. He had put a man in our family called Dad who used the belt and other forms of discipline that I thought were way out of line. Today they would be probably seen as out of line. Back then it might have been normal. And a young man that committed suicide sitting next to me. And then I started on my list of things that I started doing, and I was pretty sure me and God had come to a nice understanding of where his job was, and that was with y'all, because y'all were weak and soft, and you needed a God. I got this. I'm cool. He doesn't seem to like me anyways. So when I get here and I'm presented with this idea of what step two is, and I talked about it a little bit last week, that idea of however inadequate, right? However inadequate my understanding is, it's enough to get started. And that took that little teeny hole that I thought step two looked like to get through and opened it up to the size of a door, to the size of this room, right? And then my sponsor was kind enough to show me where in this book and how simple this was, because if step one, if alcohol did its job and I come into step one and I'm convinced that I'm beyond human aid, then there is only one solution to that. And that's a power greater than myself. Today I use the word God because I'm lazy. It's an easy word to use. And I don't have to go in and think of the divine spirit or creative intelligence of the universe, even though the book offers us all these little words to keep the walls from blocking me from this power, because when I get here, I have those walls, right? And luckily I had a sponsor who was able. And I'm just going to pull out a couple things from We Agnostics. You know, and the idea of what We Agnostics was is the first half of the chapter is designed to talk to the individual who just no longer has a relationship with the power, with God, based on these resentments, old ideas, beliefs, prejudices. And the second half of the chapter is more designed for the atheist, the so-called atheist, right? And they give us little ways, basically, to either... But the way I see it is it's written to help me help you get past these blocks. Right? That's how I see this chapter, because that's how my sponsor used this chapter, was to use the words that Bill had been inspired to put down here to help me get over the idea of this hatred towards God. And I've had some guys that we've had to walk through the idea that they don't have any belief. which is pretty hard to actually have. You have to have a belief in something. It just tends to be yourself. The book says God of reason, right? Meaning God of intellect, my own thought. And if I believe in myself, then there's no room for God. There's only room for one individual in that case, right? It says, we found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results. Even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. And these are the readings that I'm looking at on page 46 and 47. The second paragraph, well, actually, it's the first real paragraph. That's where that one's found. And then the next one is, much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another conceptions of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe, underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. Those other simple steps are 3 through 12. Right? And this is just, we kind of give you step 2, as simple as it is. We pretty much front you step 2. We've taken away all of the challenges that you can come in here with. And we just say, we need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than ourselves, greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he is on his way. On his way where? On his way to step 3. Right, that is the simplicity of this step. We're not asking you to have a belief. I'm not even sure that it does you any better to have one at that point. All we're just asking is are you willing to believe that there may be something greater than you at work here? And when my sponsor put it to me that simple, and alcohol had done its job, it was pretty easy. Yeah, I'm willing. Absolutely. Whatever you got. You know, my good friend of mine, Chris, talks about the idea of this being an experiment. And the hypothesis is that these steps will work for me. The experiment is to take the steps and let's look at the results at the end. And when I look at the results at the end, what I had at step 2 versus what I had at step 7, step 9, step 11 today, drastically different, right? The book promises that we'll have drastic upheavals, an entire psychic change. They mention God as you understand him in 3, and then they mention it again in 11. The difference between those two time periods in my life, not a long time, but in spiritual time, they were immense. Because the way I saw it at 3 and the way I see it at 11 is completely different, because this process is designed to knock down all of these walls that I've come in here with, whether it was based on growing up in the Catholic Church. I think I mentioned the idea of what Sandy Beach saw when he was sitting in church, and that was Jesus on a crucifix. And during, as a child, he you know, how, whether or not this is completely true, the idea of this story made sense to me in the Jesus up there looking down at him and said, he did this to his only son. What do you think he's going to do to you? Right? And that makes sense to me. Right? And luckily, I have a sponsor that knows this big book. And he allowed me to see how simple and gentle this step really is. Are you willing? Yeah. All right. Let's move along. And that's what we did. Right? There's one thing that I like to use. I like analogies. I like to paint pictures. It helps me, and it seems to help the new guy as well. Instead of trying to look up every single word, we can come back to this book, right, consistently. Consistently, our meeting does it. We come back and read. But if a guy's dying, some of this we need to keep. Can I be the big book? Can I represent the big book, what's in here, through my experiences, through my understanding of this book? So sometimes I like to do that through the painting of a picture, right? And the idea, because they talk about how quickly we're willing to, this book is hysterical. First and foremost, they talked about lunar flight, right? 30 years before it happened, Right? I mean, that's they basically predicted the moon landing. Pretty cool little side note there to me. But they also talk about the idea of technology and how quickly we're willing to go for the new thing. Right? Little would they know what it's like today. Right? We all have a phone that by the time you leave this meeting will be non-existent because there will be a phone out there that's better. Right? My phone's been non-existent for a couple years now, I'm pretty sure, because that's how old it is. Right? So what I would like to do is I would sit down with a young man and ask him what kind of phone he had. You know? And has he ever upgraded that based off of a commercial? We've all looked at the young girl in AT&T, and she's cute, and she talks about the new 13. And I sit there, and I'm like, ooh, that looks awesome. That phone does a lot. Now, I know nothing about this. I know none of this to be true. I know that this young lady is saying this, but I have no experience with that. Right? And but I'm willing to just go stand in line for 4 or 5 hours, get this phone, based off of the word of someone else with no experience. Then we get into a situation like, say, my life, where if I don't find a higher power, I'm going to go out and drink, and to drink is to die. And I want to see proof all of a sudden. And I need hands-on proof. Right? But I'm willing to take this phone off of the word just to have the new piece of technology. Right. So I'd like to describe that because most of us have done that based off of a commercial, based off of someone else telling me that what they have is better than what I have. So when I sit in front of this young man, I usually say, well, what I'm letting you know is what I have is better than what you have. So maybe you should just try it. Try the experiment. And that's what step two looks like to me. Right, and that's based off of the information in this book and the way it was presented to me. It's as simple as, are you willing to try? And you know, and then all of a sudden, boom, here we are in step three. Right, so alcohol has convinced me that I need a power greater than mine. AA offers me a power, not dressed up like I expected to look, but just a treasure map to that power, which come to find out they talk about for deep down in the hearts of all of every man, woman, and child. This can be found, right? The last analysis, they're consistently pointing to where this will be found. The problem is I would never think to look there. So luckily, we have this beautiful piece of literature that guides me towards it. Step three, everybody, you know, I work at a rehab, so I hear it all the time. You know, I'm really stuck on two, or I'm really working on step three. And I'm always, and my first question is well, what does that mean? What do you mean you're working on step three? And they'll usually come up with something that they're trying to write about an understanding of their God, trying to come up with an understanding before they move on. That's not what the step says. Step says we make a decision. And no decision is useful unless it's followed up by action. A decision is only as good as the action that follows it. Right, so I can make a decision that I'm going to stop speaking at, I guess, 7:30-ish. But if I don't take the action to actually stop talking, then we're going to be here until I do, or until y'all get up and leave, or someone takes this mic away. Right? So is the action that I'm taking after making this decision, though vital and necessary, right, which is what it points out, this is a decision to allow God to take over the management of my life, which in step one I've admitted I am unable to manage. Right, the bedevilments express to me why my life is unmanageable. And that is because I don't seem to be able to control the emotional natures that life rile up in me, that creates in me. You know, I extremes. I'm super high, super low. It's the idea of what life is able to do to me, where it doesn't seem like it does that to other people, and that is why my life is unmanageable. The book has it outlined in the bedevilments under, I believe it's 8 or 9 statements: personal relationships, prey to misery and depression, full of fear and anxiety, full of uselessness, couldn't make a living, things along that lines. And step three, I'm making a decision to allow this power that they promised me that I'll find to take over my thoughts and my actions. Right? Now you would think that after everything that I've done to get into these rooms, that that would seem like a pretty easy decision. I should be able to turn around and look at my life and say, this is a really good idea. I'm at 43, I'm 44, I'm in a rehab. I have nobody left in my life that's willing to stand by me. I have no money. Car's repoed. When I drink, I create harm. And yet I still fight this decision, right? Which is why the action that follows it seems to be so important. And that first part of the action I take is a personal inventory so I can see what my life looks like when it's managed by me. Right? But they do a really good job of describing why I should turn over my thoughts and my actions. Right? And they describe that and how it works. Right? And some of the ideas that they point out. They start to reference the idea of God being the director. But that's what I believe my part is. I believe I'm the director. And it starts to get me to look at the idea of what my real position is, and that is to be the actor, right? So it says, being convinced, and we're on page 60. We've just come out of reading How It Works. We've just come out of reading the ABCs, right? That we were alcoholic, could not manage our own lives. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and see that God could and would if he were sought. So there's steps one and two right there. And it says, being convinced of those ABCs, we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood them. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? And then there's a requirement. It says that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And then it goes on to describe what that life looks like when it's run on self-will. It says we are in constant collision with others. It describes what most humans look like, not just other alcoholics, but most humans. And the way I see it is as I wake up in the morning and this mind of mine has come up with a script of what my day will look like. What I don't understand is that everybody else has woken up and they have a script of what they think their day will look like. I don't realize that your script doesn't look like my script. And I expect when I come into contact with you that you will know your part in my world, because that's what you were here to do. You were here to play a part in my movie. And it is my movie. The problem is to see you wake up and you have the same idea about this movie, except you're the director, the actor, the producer. You're doing the lights and I play the bit part. Right? But I don't see that. And that's why we start to just bang and bang throughout my whole day. Just collision, right? And that's the simplicity to me of what step three looks like, is I don't understand my part. I talk about a God, but then I play the God. See, God's role is the director. So what it looks like for me in these mornings is when I wake up, I say, God, what is the script for today? What do you have for me? What are my lines? Where should I be? Right? It may not sound exactly like that, but that's the gist of what my prayer is asking. What is my day to look like? And give me the power. Because don't forget, in We Agnostics, it tells me what my problem is. And that's lack of power. That is my dilemma. Right? Now they're getting ready to tell me that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. So if my problem is lack of power, right, and what's the root do? And this is how my sponsor explained it to me. What's the root do for a tree? It feeds it. It brings it the nutrients, right, for this tree to survive. So if the tree, let's say it's me and my problem, and that's lack of power, and the root of that is selfishness and self-centeredness, it sounds like my solution to power would be to be selfless. Right? The only problem is I can't do that on my own. The book says we couldn't wish this, just like we couldn't wish drinking away. So what I need is a source of power, my higher power, to give me this power. Right? A guy used to talk to me about the little, you get the little P from the big P. Right? I get my source of power. Step 11 tells me, right? Praying only for the knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry it out. Because if lack of power is my dilemma, and that's caused by the selfishness and self-centeredness of me, then it sounds like I need something to remove that selfish and self-centeredness. And that's where God comes in. And there is the reason why I need to make this decision. Because if I don't make this decision, and I don't follow it with action, then I'm never going to get in touch and access this power that I so desperately need. Right? But the problem is my channel's blocked. See, my channel's blocked. It talks about, for deep down in the hearts of every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea. Though it may be blocked by pomp, calamity, worship of other things. Right? Pomp is this, and calamity, well, I'm sorry, pomp is me. Right? Calamity is the stuff that goes on around me on a daily, whether it be directly affecting me, or it's on the news, or it's me as a child growing up in the Catholic Church watching what those priests did. Things like that. It's just that kid committing suicide. It's those older kids. It's the things that happen in my life. It's the worship of me, money, women. Right? That's pomp, calamity, worship of other things. You want to ask yourself, you want to find out what you worship in a day. Sit down and take a look at what your mind was on for most of the day. You could do a little pie chart. Put a little pie chart out there and see what you thought about most of your day. That'll give you an idea of what your worship was on. excuse me. I apologize for that. Let's get that off. Because I didn't have the ringer on. So, seeking power, right? But it's blocked. So I need something to unblock it. And here we come into one of the things that initially I did not want to do. And that's inventory, self-examination. You know, the book says most of us only got to me inventorying your greater defects. Right? I know the spotter works. It does. Because when you pull into a parking lot and it's an Acme and there's a cart in a parking spot that you're getting ready to pull into, what is your first thought? Judgment? And pointing out the character flaws of that lazy individual for not pushing it back to the... So the spotter works, right? It's just pointed in the wrong direction, right? The receiver is not receiving properly. So I get into some inventory, right? And they give us the three instincts or instinctual areas that seem to be the ones that everybody suffers from, resentments. And that's my judgments, my grudges, my anger towards, in my case, everyone. I come into this program, I am a person who blames everyone. I'm not the self-pity guy, and that's just the resentment and anger turns inwards. I'm the pointer, right? I heard a guy say it the other day, his blame thrower. I like that, right? That made sense to me. So there's my resentments, right? And I have an extensive list of them. And then they go into fears. I'm a tough kid from Washington, D.C. I don't have any fears. Until it's explained to me what those fears look like and I start writing, I've realized I'm a little kid full of fears. I'm not this tough guy. I have no idea how to handle situations. And when I get fearful, I get angry, which means I get violent. Doesn't mean I'm tough. It means I do not know how to handle fear. Right? And that's what my father looked like. So that's what I was raised under, right? I don't know how to handle fear. That whole fight or flight idea, right? I tend to do both. First we'll fight, and then I'm running, right? And it's not always a physical thing, but I certainly visited a few jails for that. And then we have sex inventory, you know, and here I thought this was going to be the exciting part of this. You know, I'm new to this, and I'm thinking, ooh, sex inventory, great. We get to talk about all this. I'm excited. And my sponsor could probably saw it in my eyes and was like, it's not what you think, kid. I was, duh, duh. I was getting ready to show off, right? And then he told me another thing, and this is not to be crude, but he said, and by the way, women that you've paid to come be your partner, don't count either. And I was like, oh, okay. Right? Because that's what, and that's not to be crude, but that's to let you know how far I had fallen. Right? That is what this book talks about. No matter how far we have fallen, we will find it's one of the promises. Right? I mean, that's who was willing to be around me in my life. So I get to this inventory, and I got some, oh man, I got some horrible things in there. Horrible. Right? And it was pointed out to me about the resentments. Right? In these resentments, it says it was the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Anything. I believe Bill's words were inspired for a reason. So when I see words like anything, completely, utterly, abandoned, words like that, I have to believe them. So he's letting me know that anything, that's more than alcohol. That's kind of crazy to me. But then it tells me why. And it says, because from it stemmed all forms of spiritual disease. For we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. And then here is the least used line, I believe, in my experience. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And to me, what they're describing here is if I go through these steps and I get connected to this power and I do this inventory and I start making amends, then the mental, which I believe has a few couple things in there. One of it, though, is definitely the mental obsession we'll get right. The physical, it was described to me that what they were referring to is not just physically, but like physical. Our personal relationships will get right if I get spiritually right. It says, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. Right? We listed people, institutions, or principles. First column. Right? We asked ourselves why we were angry. Second column. It said, on this grudge list, it gives us another little word to use instead of resentments. You know, I had a guy approach me the other day. He says, yeah, I don't really feel like I have any resentments. And I was like, really? Okay. Do you ever feel smugly superior to anyone? Right? And I heard that one from Bob Darrow. And the guy was like, well, yeah. I was like, do you ever judge anyone? And I kept bringing up, and by the end, and the funny thing was, is I could give him three because he'd been sharing them with me over the last week. One of it was like the sober house he was living in, the institution, right? And I'm sitting there and I'm listening to him, and I don't have any. And I'm like, well, I could name three for you. But then I tried to help. And Bill gives us words, burned up, right? If you think about this person, do you go flush? That's kind of how I see it. Can I immediately remember the story about you? Do I dodge you? Do I look at the phone when you call and go, If I see you somewhere, do I turn and go the other way? Right? Do I get uncomfortable when you're near me? Or if someone else is talking about you? So then it says, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations? There's column three. They go on to say, the problem is usually we stop right there. No one ever. Right? There's the spotter. Point outwards. And this fourth column asked me to turn this around. Right? So I'm going to share what a resentment looked like and how my sponsor walked me through into that fourth column. We're going to use my dad. And you'll hear my dad used a few times. He was a powerful individual in my life. And not always in a good way. So I come to him and I say, you know, I got this resentment against my father. He beat me, beat my mom, didn't do what fathers were supposed to do, wasn't supportive, blah, blah, blah. The normal BS about a father, especially coming from a man like me who has never been one. And I have this idea that I think I know what a father is supposed to look like. But I don't. I don't have kids. Right? So I have a sponsor who says, okay. All right, and then we go through the columns, right? What it hurt everything. You know, my little X on everything, all of it. Self-esteem, personal relationships, crushed my sex relationships because he was a terrible person and he didn't show me what a married couple was supposed to look like, and so on and so forth. And we get to that fourth one, what was my part? And I don't really have anything written there. You know, my sponsor's like, really? Okay, all right. So let's play with this. And he says, what was your father like? Is his childhood like? Right? Because what he's trying to do is get me to look at this from an entirely different angle, which is what the book says. Right? We were prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle. I can't look at it from any other angle except the one I see it from. Because if I'm selfish and self-centered, then that's the angle I'm going to see it from. And if I'm wrapped in this resentment, then there is no other angle. So I need to get out of that. And I have my emotions attached to that angle. So his job as a sponsor is to get me out of that angle so I can get out of that emotion. Right? And it's also to teach me how to do this from here on out. Right? That's the beauty of this. We have an amazing fear prayer in there. Right? The idea of, let me see this individual as sick as am I. See, normally I see me as sick and I see you as an asshole. Right? I don't want to see you as sick. I want to see you as an asshole. I'm sick. And then it says, so that I can be of use to you, God, and to him. Right? I mean, we're talking about a couple things this prayer is asking me to do. First, it's asking me to pray, which is the last thing I want to do when I'm angry. Next, it's asking me to look at this man as sick, which I don't want to do. And then, I want to do those two things so that I can be useful to this individual. I definitely don't want to do that. I don't want to. So that is why I believe this prayer is so powerful and why it works so well, because it's asking me to do three things I do not want to do at that given moment. Right? So I'm looking at my father and he's telling me, what was your father's childhood like? And I'm like, he was raised by a violent alcoholic, a mother who had to work two jobs. So he was raised on the streets of D.C. by the guys on the street. Wasn't exactly a big dude. And joined what they would call today a gang. Back then it was called like a gentleman's club or something. They would wear carnigans with their names on the back, right? The drapes, go to the dances. You know, these guys grew up in D.C., they were dancers. And they would fight. And that was basically what they did. They would fight other clubs. And that was his life, right? So he starts asking me some other things about him. And pretty soon I'm starting to catch on to what he's trying to do. He's trying to get me to look at my father with some empathy. A little bit of sympathy, maybe even compassion, right? Because all I see is an angry man. And now all of a sudden I got to start looking at him. What was he given? What kind of tools was he given? If he doesn't have a God in his life, what does his actions look like? What did my actions look like when I don't have a God in my life? I'm angry. I cause harm to people. My first reaction to fear is anger. Second reaction is violence. What was his? Now all of a sudden we're starting to kind of look a little bit alike. Now I'm starting to feel a little hypocritical about my actions here. Right? I have a tattoo right here and it says, I am that too. T-O-O. I am that also. Right? And the idea of that is compassion. And that means my struggle identifies with your struggle. Right? And and that's what the idea is of it in Greek, I believe, or perhaps Latin. I don't know. It's written in English, that's all I know. So the idea is my struggle identifies with your struggle. Right? And now all of a sudden I start to feel that with my father. I can start to identify with his struggle. I can recognize when my sponsor says, do you think he caused this harm to you because he hated you?
No.
Did he do things that were good for the family? Yeah, we had a house. I got to all my sporting events. We went on vacations. Food was on the table. Do you think perhaps that's what he thought a father was supposed to be, since that's not what his father did? Now all of a sudden I'm really starting to shift, because now I'm seeing that maybe this man did what he thought was what he was supposed to do. Maybe that was the best that he had. Right? And I move on. Because now I'm free of that resentment. Now it took me a little more inventory to get free of all of it. The roots were deep on this one, right? But that one gave me some breathing room, right? I was able to sit down with that man and make an amazing amends. And I'll share that possibly later on, probably next week. Fear. That is not taking the action that the step three prayer has asked me to do, and that is to get out of the management game, stop being self-reliant, but to be God-reliant. And these fears that come up at any given point are basically me relying on God. Now, obviously, of course, there's some real life fears, and that is our fear instinct that is God-given, right? This idea of protection. And those are pretty easy. Stay out of those ways and follow that instinct if you're in a bad neighborhood, those type of things. But those aren't my fears. My fears are success, failure, being alone, being committed to a relationship, recovery, relapse. I play both sides, right? Because I haven't had success at either one of them. You know, and that's based on self. It tells me I am finite. I am bound to fail at some point, just like any other human's bound to fail me at some point. That's why my reliance has to be on something greater, and that's God. God reliance is the solution to fear. And that's what our prayer says. God, remove this fear of speaking in front of y'all so that I may be what you would have me be. What would I have? What would I have him have me be? What would he have me be? The position that we talked about in step three: child, actor, agent, student, happy, joyous, free. And as soon as I start getting those thoughts into my mind, I recognize I'm relying on me, and I move on because I start thinking of God at that moment. Right? What would he have me be? And just a child, just out here doing God's work. Right, inventory. You want to know the simplicity of inventory for me? It says it doesn't matter when I say I love you, I still bring me. I say I love you, and I still cause harm to you because my character flaws come in even stronger with those who are closer. Right now, it gives me some ideas. It gives me, you know, did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, bitterness? Right, words like that. And I've never heard those words. That doesn't make sense to me until I start doing the inventory. Right, so we got a resentment prayer, we got a fear prayer, and then we have three sex prayers. So that'll probably give you an idea of how much trouble they knew that this would cause. Right, the one that I enjoy is the one that says, God, please help mold me, mold these sex ideals. Right, what does that look like in my life today? Well, I take that fourth column of a sex inventory, and I see the opposites. Right. Well, I was dishonest. God help me be honest, loving, caring, considerate, compassionate, passionate, playful, giving in spirit. And this is my sex ideals. Right. And then I make it into a prayer because it says we ask God. So it sounds like I could write a prayer with these things. And I do, and I write a prayer. And guess what? I take that to God. And the relationship I have today is wrapped around those things. And guess what? The beauty is sex inventory isn't just about the individual that I am intimate with. It's about all my personal relationships. And I can take that prayer and use it, and it helps me be those things in all of my personal relationships. Right? I'm the type of guy who says I love you a week into a relationship. Because there's things you have that I need. Right? It's going to get me in your pants, your pocketbook, your house. Right? Because I don't have probably the house for much longer. Wherever I'm living ain't going to last long. You got more money, you're better with it. And I'm a guy, and I, you know, if you sleep with me, then that means I'm okay. I'm okay. And if you stay with me, then I'm okay. Because no matter how chaotic my life looks, if I have a young woman with me, then it must be okay. And I think that's what y'all think, right? So I make sure I always had a girl. And so when we get to this inventory, holy cow, you know, I get blown out of the water. You know what I find out about myself? Holy cow, I'm a sexist. Yeah, sexist. I was like, oh, God, that hurts. Right? And guess who helped me see that? Was a woman. Because I took my inventory to a woman as well. Who? You want to get freedom? Take it to the opposite sex. They'll help you. She is powerful. Powerful. Person or persons. So the book says, man, I follow directions today, right? Gets me free, right? What's that look like? That looks like my mom had a 40-hour-a-week job, but guess what her real job was? And this is what I grew up around. Kids taken care of, food on the table, house clean, laundry done, right? And that's what my role, that's how I see women. Oh, great, great, you got a job. Where's my stuff? Where am I? You're second, right? And I find women that are injured. and I push him down a little bit farther, and then I help him up. I help him up, and I look like the knight in shining armor. And that's the game I play. Right? And then you can't leave me because I saved you. Right? See, I don't mess around. I do this. I do this inventory, and I'm free of it. And that's why I can sit here and share it with y'all without being embarrassed by it. This is the type of man I was and can still be at any given moment when I'm not connected to this power. I can't be in a good relationship unless I have God. Why? Because I don't have that kind of power. Lack of power, right? Feeds my selfishness, self-centeredness, right? So I come out of that. I share all this with this man. And then I lied to him. Then I lied to him, just like the book says. And I held out the darkest one, right? Because I already had that word on there one other time. And that word looks scary to say. It even hurts me to say it. Now it's going to be on there twice. And this one's carried with some serious taboo. And I'm like, ooh, no, not a chance. And 5 months later, I'm dying. I'm dying. I got commitments. I'm doing everything with none of the fifth step promises, none of them. And I can't understand. And I'm sitting in a meeting one day and a girl says something and I went, and it hit me. And the iceberg started to shatter at that moment that I had lied and that I had withheld and that I had not gotten the things that the fifth step says. I had not learned enough about humility. I had not learned enough about the ego. Right? I had not lost enough. I had not gotten down to right size. And I reached out to my boy Chris because my sponsor wasn't available. And I went to him and I got free with him. And then I went to my sponsor and got free with him. And boom, it happened. Now I could actually sit down and do a real 6 and 7, right? Because that whole time, how am I going to do a real 6 and 7 if I'm going in there on the lie? That means I didn't answer the questions at the end of the fifth step, right? I didn't know it was the fifth step initially. And we'll go to, let's see. I had this all marked out nice and neat. Let's see. I'm going to have it here somewhere. Okay, so at the bottom of page 75, right, it says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. I thought that was interesting, but any other time that they've given me a timeline, it seems to have had a main purpose. Right at the end of step 3, it says, we launch out onto a course of vigorous action. Right, next. It uses next and now. Those are two important words. Right, I get up off my knees after saying the third step prayer with this man, and we start talking about writing inventory immediately. That's what I do with the guys I have today. We get up off our knees. I express to them what that third step prayer means. It's the first time we're exposed, at least my experience, that I'm exposed to a selfless prayer. God, take this away so I can be more useful to you. God, give me this so I can be more useful to you. Right? Remove this so I can be more useful to you. Those aren't my prayers. My prayers are give me. Give me. Right? So I get introduced to this selfless prayer. The beautiful thing about it is it says, we said something like this. The words were quite optional as long as the was expressed, as long as the meaning was expressed, which means, guess what? You could write your own third step prayer if you wanted, as long as you had the expression behind it, the meaning behind it, right? And I know people that do that. Right? So it says, returning home for an hour, carefully reviewing what we've done, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him. A nice little prayer. Know Him better. Taking this book down from the shelf, we turn to the page, which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything. For we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Right? Have we omitted anything? Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? And if you go back into different parts of this book in those first 62 pages, you will find references to everything that they're talking about. But the gist is when you get to step 1, have you come to understand that you're powerless and that your life is unmanageable? Are you willing to believe that you need a power greater than yourself? Are you willing to take this experiment? Have you made the decision based on this information Were you honest and thorough? Did you admit anything? There's my trap. Boom, I'm done, right? I couldn't have possibly had a sixth and seventh experience. Right? Admitted anything. Right? So I lied on that. So there's, now I come back. So let me readdress that. Now I can look at that and I can answer these questions. We're building an arch, right? It talks about you have the foundation of step one, you have the cornerstone of step two. Cornerstone is the first stone put in place when you're building a structure. From it stem all measurements, right? If that one's in place, you usually come off the walls properly and so on. Right? And then it talks about the keystone, which is the arch. The arch in the middle of the brick in the middle of the arch, right? And if everything has been come to that, it should meet like this in the arch. Boom, that keystone slides right down in the middle, right? So if I've done everything properly up until that point, that third step decision should be locked in with this action I'm going to take in four and continue, right? And five, right? And then it says, when I flip the page, if we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step six. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, every one? And it lets me know how, if I don't have that, what do I do? It says if we still cling to something he will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. The problem is there's certain things that I find, I'm not quite sure they're that objectionable. They're not that bad, right? So I hold on to him. And he takes the grosser handicaps away, right? And I try to hold on to some of the other ones. And there's not a true surrender, right? This is, some people refer to it as a second surrender. I think it's a continual surrender. I think as humans, we are bound to try to take these things back. Lust, greed. You know, I look at my character flaws. What do they look like, right? Procrastination, jealous, envy, right? Things like that. And some of them, you know, judgment. I mean, is it really bad when I'm right? See, that's not, I don't find that objectionable. So then I battle with being judgmental of people for a little while until finally I get in enough pain because I'm kind of getting sick of myself being so judgmental. I'm getting sick of myself, and finally I have another surrender with that, and I give that to God. And then, you know, I look at it like this when it comes to these character flaws. Being human and being flawed, right? We're never gonna be given to perfection. It's just impossible. I feel like it's like a plant, right? And it has all these leaves, and all these leaves are my character flaws. And I hand this plant to God in this surrender, and I say, here. Take all of this. Thank you. And then I slowly, over time, start taking a leaf back at a time. And I just start taking a leaf back. And what that looks like is I start becoming a little jealous again. I start getting a little more greedy. You know, and it stops being 100%. It's starting to be a little 80% on the lust and on anything of that nature. And pretty soon I look down and the plant's back in my lap. Right, and I have to go back through a surrender, and that usually requires some inventory. Right, and I go back through this, and I go back through the surrender, and I give it back to God. And this time, when it starts to happen, I seem to take back a little less and a little less. And that's just been my experience. Right, but I have to be willing, and I have to find it objectionable. And if I don't, then I pray for it. Right, and then we get into step seven. And it's the idea of the prayer, right? At the end of the third step prayer, you notice that there's no amen. It was described to me that the end of the seventh step prayer is the end of that prayer as a whole. And that's why there's an amen at the end of the seventh step prayer. Because the third step prayer, the work done in between, and then the seventh step prayer are a culmination of that action. Of what we're asking for in the third step and what we're asking for in the seventh is it's just an extended prayer. I don't know that to be exactly true. That could be opinion, but I've heard that described to me by many people who I have high opinions of in this program who have studied this thing for a lot longer than I have. So it makes sense to me. And if you look at the wording of each prayer, they are very similar. Right? Seven-step prayer. It says, my Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. And that lets me know, it says the good and the bad, but it also lets me know that in God's hands, things that I may consider bad may stay around because they're useful in His hands. See, character flaws aren't useful in my hands at all. I can look at pride. Pride, the idea of I care what everybody thinks about me to an extreme. And that's what pride looks like in my life. I am concerned what everybody thinks about me. In God's hands, it is a motivating force for me to stay active in this. It gives me the idea that driving an hour and 45 minutes is something that I've been invited to do. And maybe I should do it. Right? My pride says, my God, look at you. They're going to think you're pretty awesome for driving so far. But that's not what this is about. Right? In God's hands, pride is I'm doing this because I was invited. And I've been invited to do something like this. And I should say yes because AA has done so much for me. Why couldn't I? Right? Why couldn't I? And that's how I see the difference between what it says here and what it says, just to read it again. You remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Right? Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. See, again, it's one of those prayers. I'm now willing you should have all of me. I pray that you remove from me. Why? So that I can be useful. Grant me strength as I go out from here. Why? So I can do your bidding. Right? The third step prayer. Let's see here. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thy will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Take away some things so I can do your work. Take away some things so I can do your work. Give me some things so I can do your work. Right? Reminding me of ever, so often, of what my position is and what this third step decision has asked me to do, and that is take that position. He is the director, I am the actor. I wake up in the morning, I ask him for my script. Every now and then I wake up and I want to run on my script and I bump heads with the people that I come into contact with. Right? But this book lets me know. We believe our problems are of our own making. Right? And that's beautiful. Because that means I just need to get right. I don't need 8.2 billion people to get right. Right? Because if it's me, it's going to be probably a lot easier for this to go better. Because I just got to get right with God. If I need all of y'all to get right, for me to be right, it's going to be ugly. It's going to be ugly. Because that means all of y'all better be working a program. And there's a lot of non-alcoholics that I run into. They don't have to work a program. They don't suffer from this disease. Right? That's all I got.